You are listening to We Saw the Devil, an investigative and conversational true crime podcast that deep dives into fascinating criminal cases that are solved, unsolved, or ongoing. From America's Lori Vallow to Germany's Armin Mivas, we examine and discuss the world's most shocking cases. If you're enjoying the show, don't forget to follow us online. Check us out at WeSawTheDevil.com and WeSawTheDevil on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, you can become part of the show by backing us on Patreon. Hello, everyone. You are listening to We Saw the Devil. This is Robin, and I am back with part two of All About Cannibalism. Everything you've wanted to know about it, but were too afraid to Google. Because, guys, let's face it, Google Images, like when you Google something, Google Images can come up with some really sus stuff at times, stuff that you may not want to see. So here's a series for you. In part one, we discussed an overview of the seven different types of cannibalism. So for this episode, we're going to go into those a little bit more deeply, and then there will be a part three, which is going to tie it up with the topic of pathological cannibalism, your serial killers, your sadists, and so forth. Fun time, guys, so strap in. But before we get into that, let's just go over a little bit of housekeeping. First and foremost, speaking to my patrons, the stickers came in. As everyone knows, or you may have known, or if you're new here, first, hi. We just recently rebranded, new logo, new merch, new everything, and the stickers finally came in. So those are going to be going out to all of our patrons over the next couple of days. So first and foremost, have to thank our patrons and let you guys know stickers have arrived, the eagle has landed, and you guys will be getting mail soon. Secondly, next up on the docket is part two of the Marilyn Monroe series. So episode one for the Marilyn Monroe series, I discussed her life, the tragedy that was her life. I had absolutely no idea. As I've gotten older, I've started researching some of the old Hollywood starlets. I don't know why, but I think Betty Davis is actually what did it for me, and Marlene Dietrich. I started watching documentaries about these very, very strong women, these very strong personalities, and the drama behind the scenes and in old Hollywood, and how so many of them were so forward thinking for their times. And it's just so fascinating to me. Right now, I'm about 70% finished with Marlene Dietrich's biography written by her daughter. And it's really fascinating stuff. I know that pop culture, a lot of people are obsessed with Marilyn Monroe, and I've never understood why. Never looked into it. I've seen a couple of films with her in it, you know, obvious classics, and I'm a film junkie, but I didn't know anything about her. So I decided to devote an incredible amount of research into her life and history, and I was actually completely shocked, just completely blown away. So that was part one. Part two is going to be focusing on the death, conspiracy theories, what we know, things that have come out since her death. Things that have come out since her death, like from the FBI, CIA files, and private investigators, and things like that. It's really fascinating stuff, and that should be coming up at the tail end of this week. Beyond that, don't forget you can follow us all across social media. If you want to find that, you can look up We Saw the Devil, or you can go to our website, WeSawTheDevil.com. From there, you can access everything, as well as if you're interested in financially backing the show, follow our Patreon. And as always, before we get into it, make sure, not even just this show, guys, if you're loving a podcast you're listening to, take 2 seconds just to go to iTunes, whatever platform you're listening on, and leave that 5-star review. It means the absolute world to us in many different ways. All right, so now that our housekeeping is out of the way, guys, let's get into it. Cannibalism is one of my favorite topics. I know that makes me sound absolutely batshit insane, but I'm so absolutely fascinated by it, just the nature of it, the psychology of it. Why do people do it? And in the last episode, I touched on the main types of cannibalism and lightly defined them. Again, just for a refresher, they are 1, nutritional cannibalism, 2, symbolic, 3, survival, 4, auto-cannibalism, 5, epicurean, 6, ritual, and 7, pathological. And as I said, for this episode, we're going to start going through them and talk about major points or even actual cases. By the end of this series, you're pretty much going to be a cannibalism pro and have some amazing facts at your next dinner party, I promise. So let's start with nutritional cannibalism. Nutritional cannibalism is cannibalism where there's no evidence of it being done for ritual or spiritual purposes. Basically, this is the act of cannibalizing someone for nutrition, for sustenance. And if you think about it, guys, in the modern age, with realistic food sources generally available to most of us, there's no excuse to cannibalize a human being under normal circumstances. Can we please just kind of all agree on that? That's why a major question that historians, anthropologists, and archaeologists are trying to answer is just how cannibalistic were our ancestors? And it's unlikely that they will actually get a definitive answer to that question for a variety of reasons. Were certain killings for survival? Were they nutritional in nature, ritual? There's actually a criteria that archaeologists and forensic anthropologists use while analyzing remains that can identify cannibalism. But the reasoning behind it could still potentially remain a mystery. So the general consensus is that no one in the modern day needs to cannibalize in order to eat, in order to receive sustenance and nutrition. But what's so interesting is that forensic anthropologists use the same set of criteria when analyzing a set of remains in order to determine whether cannibalism has taken place. So whether this is someone like a Jeffrey Dahmer victim or this is someone from 1492, the criteria is the same when looking at these bones, at the remains. So we're going to go through those. There are 13 of them. The first is lack of a cranial base on otherwise complete or near complete skeletons. Unless your name is Frankenstein, Victor Frankenstein, and you're trying to reanimate the dead, you likely have no reason for opening up the floor of the cranial cavity. You're probably trying to get direct access to the brain at this point. You know, apparently the brain, and fun fact, if you look up what part, and I did this, and you can do this as well, like what part of humans tastes the best, apparently it is the brain as well as like tendons, like muscles. So fun fact of the day, apparently with people, the brain stays the best. And apparently 9 out of 10 cannibals agree. 2, absence of vertebrae. Supposedly it's a known thing that vertebrae can be crushed or boiled in order to get to the marrow. So that's a very common thing. Obviously, 3, cut and chop marks for rudimentary tools, knives, things like that. 4, cut mark arrangement, position, number, and placement. 5, long bone breakage. Again, that's to access the bone marrow. And 6, anvil abrasions. And this is a really, really fascinating topic. I went down this rabbit hole for hours. An anvil abrasion, that's a faint parallel scratch or scratches, shall I say, that are found on bones, most often on skulls. And it's caused when the head, or a very large bone, is placed on a rock that serves as an anvil. Another rock or sharp instrument is brought down onto the head or bone in order to break it open. Think like a coconut. When the strike occurs, a certain amount of slippage and friction takes place, causing very clear abrasions on the bone itself, so like, let's say, on the skull. And this is primarily done in order to get whatever matter is inside. So again, brains, marrow, whatever. But there are some really interesting pictures of this as far as examples. And don't worry about being grossed out. A lot of it is historical. If you want to take a look at it, like, these bones are long gone, very old. You can actually see the strike marks on the bones where they were, for all intents and purposes, butchered. 7, comparable butchering techniques on human remains as in regular food remains. That speaks for itself. 8, discarding of human remains similar to faunal remains. 9, evidence of cooking in the form of burnt bone. 10, a roughened bone surface with parallel grooves or fibrous texture is produced when fresh bone is fractured and peeled apart. 11, percussion pits, the point of impact where a stone or any solid matter struck the bone cortex and scarred the surface. 12, scraping marks. And 13, last but not least, human tooth marks. James Cole, an archaeologist from the University of Brighton in England, studied nutritional human cannibalism during the Paleolithic period. He published his research in the scientific journal in April of 2017. And just so none of you get any ideas here, let me just share his conclusion. Cole concluded that humans are not really worth eating for nutritional value. And here's a direct quote. The meat on one human's body could have provided a group of 25 modern adult males with enough calories to survive for only about half a day. In contrast, that same tribe during Paleolithic times could have feasted on a mammoth, which with 3.6 million calories would have provided enough sustenance for 60 days. Even a steppe bison would offer 612,000 calories, enough for 10 days of nourishment. So the moral of the story, guys, is that humans have very, very little nutritional value, and it's usually pretty simple from an archaeological standpoint to see if the remains were cannibalized. So moving on, we have symbolic cannibalism. And fun fact, did you know that Roman pagans used to call early Christians cannibals? That's because they spoke of, quote, eating and drinking their god. Symbolic cannibalism is the eating of human flesh or human parts by humans either in actuality or by substitution, which has as its purpose functional, symbolic, or psychological definitions of a group or person. And Catholic communion is actually a great example of this. Because of the belief in the real presence, taking this portion of the Bible literally, Catholics don't believe anyone is ready or able to experience the Eucharist unprepared. Children and new Catholics are educated before receiving their first Holy Communion. And all Catholics are expected to go to confession, at least once a year, but preferably more often, obviously, in order to be more worthily prepared. The Catholic Church, and I find this so fascinating, the Catholic Church itself has even directly responded to accusations of symbolic cannibalism. And you can go to the Catholic Church's website right now as you are listening to this. And it says on their official website, quote, "Yet the charge of cannibalism is misplaced. Cannibalism, simply put, is the eating of human flesh, typically after a person has died. A corpse is usually present, or at least a dead body part. Second, the quantity of the flesh diminishes as it is being consumed. Third, digesting flesh results in physical nourishment, protein included. In the banquet of the Eucharist, however, Jesus is not dead, but is a living sacrifice. Second, his substance is not diminished by consuming the Eucharist. To the contrary, Jesus is bodily in heaven, seated at the right hand of the Father, though his body becomes miraculously present wherever the Eucharist is celebrated. Third, the eating of his body and blood does not result in practical physical nourishment on a natural level, although some have miraculously subsisted solely on the Eucharist. The purpose of the Eucharist is to provide spiritual nourishment." And I find, guys, I find that amazing that a church actually had to reply to dispel rumors that communion is cannibalism. I just find that so, no pun intended, delicious that they even had to do that. Either way, behavior like that, which is similarly found in many religions across the globe, it is still considered symbolic cannibalism. Do you guys remember the old Looney Tunes cartoons where either Bugs Bunny or Elmer Fudd, they would get stranded on a desert island in some remote place, and then they would start to hallucinate, and then they would see like all their little friends turn into steaks or roasted turkeys, Christmas hams, things like that? That's survival cannibalism, kind of. Survival cannibalism is the act of consuming the flesh of another person for the purpose of surviving. It's the kind of cannibalism that is the most forgivable by most societies. And it's terrifying. This is actually, you know, whatever to Jeffrey Dahmer, whatever to anything else, survival cannibalism is the most terrifying to me because it's not a paraphilia. It's not a cultural thing. It's not anything taught. It's innate. It is a biological response to severe hunger and dying. If you look at any true crime podcast at any given time, you're going to notice a handful of cases that are almost always present. You'll have your Dahmers, your Gacy episodes, well-known killers, missing people, unsolved murders. And one of the most beaten to death cases pretty much on the planet is the Donner Party. And now I'm going to cover it too. So I'm joining the club now. In 1846, a group of pioneers decided to expand westward, going to California from Iowa. 81 of them broke off from the original party as they decided to take a shortcut through the Sierra Nevada mountains. Bad life choice. The terrain was so rocky and impassable that they were stranded in the mountains as winter hit. The terrain was so rocky, in fact, that all of their wagons burst down, the wheels came off, and they were basically shit out of luck. The group later split again until a smaller group was left. Then their supplies started depleting. They ate their horses, the pack animals. Then they ate the dogs and the cats. And lastly, they made soups out of boiled hides from the animals and leather that they had in their cargo holds. After that, they had nothing. They were starving. So they began to eat those who died. And there are also reports that some were killed in order to be eaten and consumed by others. There were 15 solo travelers on the trip originally, and all but two of them died. All in all, 45 out of 81 people returned to civilization. And that is considered one of the biggest mysteries as far as what the hell happened on that trip. If you're interested in the Donner Party, there are countless books, articles, and documentaries on it. Next up was the Siege of Leningrad. The Siege of Leningrad was a nearly three-year bombardment by German Nazi forces against the city of what is now St. Petersburg. It lasted for three whole years. During the siege, more than 1 million people died. And to put that in comparison, guys, 135,000 people perished in the bombing of Hiroshima, either immediately or shortly thereafter due to, you know, radiation exposure. For 3 years, the people of Leningrad slowly starved to death, and they had absolutely no way to replenish their food supplies because the German army completely surrounded the city. The citizens had a daily ration of a piece of bread the size of a bar of soap, and they did everything they could to survive. They ate glue, they made petroleum jelly soup, they boiled anything leather or cloth that they could find, and they also tried to eat fur coats. And cannibalism became such a problem in Leningrad in 1941 that police were forced to create a unit just to combat the roving gangs of cannibals looking for meat, looking for something to eat to survive. Neighborhoods had lookouts, and parents would actually keep their children home at night and during the day just to keep them from being kidnapped and eaten. And after the siege was over, more than 260 people, by the end of this, had been arrested and jailed for cannibalism. And did you know that there is a huge case for cannibalism at Jamestown? Yeah, America's first colony. In the winter of 1609, which many historians call the starving time, I mean, as if that's not fucking ominous enough by itself, food shortages and drought actually wiped out 80% of the colony. In 2012, archaeologists unearthed remains of a 14-year-old girl who had been named Jane. She was located in a cellar. The remains were also found with dog and horse bones that showed signs of butchering. Remember, go back to the criteria of how forensic anthropologists determine whether remains had been cannibalized. They sent these remains to the Smithsonian, and the Smithsonian had their own forensics team look at the bones. Well, the dental analysis revealed that the girl was around 14 years of age, but the meat of their discovery, cheesy pun intended, was pretty shocking. She had been butchered. There were those deep cuts at the base of her skull, and even signs of scraping from a sharp knife on her jaw, on her mandible, as well as other parts of her skeleton. Someone was trying to get every ounce of flesh off of the bones as they could. And it's a really fascinating story. I mean, due to the marshy location of Jamestown, they picked a shit place to colonize, to found this fort. The water had dangerously high levels of salt. The land was not made for farming, and the colonists didn't even try. So many factors played into the entire settlement almost dying off. But regardless, this is considered the biggest, like most massive evidence of cannibalism at Jamestown. So obviously people are going to resort to some unsavory things. And that brings us to Yellow Jackets, the TV show. No, I'm kidding. That brings us to the Uruguayan Flight 571. And this to me is just an absolutely heartbreaking case. This case has also been covered quite a bit on various true crime podcasts out there. There are lots of books, also written by books that are written by the survivors themselves. It's so emotionally intense. On Friday, October 13th, 1972, Uruguayan Flight 571 was carrying 40 players, friends, and family of a Uruguayan college rugby team. They were planning to go to Chile for a game. And as they were traveling through the Andes in Argentina, they encountered dense clouds and fog. The pilot, who was incredibly young and inexperienced, thought that he was actually descending down into Chile in the airport. And once the fog suddenly cleared, he was like, oh shit, that mountainside is just about 10, 15 foot away from the side of this big plane. And it was too late to correct. They crashed. Multiple times, actually. The tail of the plane ripped off the fuselage. Five players and two crew members were immediately sucked out of the gaping hole and died. They actually flew right out of the hole in the plane. The plane was nosediving down the side of the mountain, and it finally hit the ground at the base of the mountain and came to a stop, killing both pilots. Those who survived and weren't seriously injured immediately set out to build a shelter. So keep in mind, they were all like 18 through like 23, 24, other than their friends and family members. But those who were not immediately injured set out to build a shelter. They used seat cushions for shoes. They tried to find ways to melt water, to drink, to cover their eyes because of snow blindness. Any ways to stay warm. The nighttime temperatures plunged to negative 22 and negative 30 degrees Fahrenheit. For food, because this was supposed to be such a short trip, the pickings were slim. They had 8 chocolate bars, 3 jars of jam, a tin of mussels, nuts, dried fruit, some candy, and a bottle of wine. That's it. The supplies dwindled very quickly, and one survivor ate one single peanut over the course of 3 days. They had no way to contact anyone to report the crash. They had no paint or any way to make a marker for anyone who would happen to go into the Andes Mountains to rescue them. And they did attempt. They found a tube of women's lipstick, and they tried to write SOS on top of the crash plane. But because it had to be so big, they actually ran out and weren't able to complete it. By day 9, starvation was setting in. So they began to eat cotton and leather from the wreckage and realized that it just wasn't an option. It was making them violently ill. So they considered the alternative. Looking at the deceased passengers around them, they knew what the answer was. It was that day, on day 9, that the remaining survivors made a joint decision and agreement to eat one another should they also pass. Robert Canessa, a medical student, was the first to begin. He used a piece of broken glass from the plane's windshield to cut off a tiny piece of flesh from one of the frozen bodies. And in a memoir he would go on to write years later after being rescued, he wrote, quote, "We laid the thin strips of frozen flesh aside on a piece of sheet metal. Each of us finally consumed our piece when we could bear it. Each of us came to our own decision in our own time. And once we had done so, it was irreversible. It was our final goodbye to innocence." The bodies of the pilot and co-pilot were first because the survivors didn't personally know them. Jose Luis Inciarte, a 24-year-old player and survivor of this entire ordeal, would also later write, quote, "We were going to die starving. We made between us, those who were still alive because the dead couldn't speak for themselves, a pact. It was the most wonderful pact I've ever seen between man and that situation. In essence, it was to honor life. Making the decision to eat the human flesh of our friends and then doing it, executing it, it was a great space between each other. The hand doesn't obey with you, and the mouth doesn't want to open. The throat can't swallow. It was very difficult. It took many days to eat one piece. I ate so little." Some would not resort to cannibalism. One female survivor refused, and she died on day 60, weighing just 54 pounds. Also on day 60, Robert Canessa ironically decided to hike down the mountain towards what would be Chile. He made it, and he came into contact with men who were fishing in a river. He wrote down on paper what had happened, and they reported it and brought it to police, who in turn reported it to the military. The group would be rescued on day 72 by 3 Chilean military helicopters. And there was an absolute media frenzy shit show when the survivors returned home, and initially it was all very positive. They became celebrities, until one of them revealed they had been forced to commit cannibalism in order to survive. And then that set off an absolute hellstorm of epic proportions. Locals could just not perform the mental gymnastics required to reconcile the fact that they ate their friends in order to survive, and then the press strictly went negative. They were even shunned from Uruguayan society. They had their homes egged. People shunned them out of grocery stores and shops. The Catholic Church even spoke out against them, furthering that negativity. And then one of them, and this is the most brilliant thing I've ever heard, one of them came up with the idea to say that they had been inspired by the Last Supper. You know, where Jesus gave his disciples bread and wine, and then he stated that they were his body and his blood. Well, the added religious sentiment tipped the scales of public perception in their favor, and then the church later absolved them of any wrongdoing, which you can't do it in order to stay alive, but if you just say that you were doing it for Jesus, it's okay, I guess. But I digress. In the first part of the series, I said we've all committed auto-cannibalism, and we do. We naturally consume dead cells from our tongue in cheek. As you are sitting there in your car, at home, whatever you're doing, listening to this episode right now, you are performing auto-cannibalism. Your body is. But when you were a kid, did you ever eat a booger, pick a scab, anything like that? Do you currently chew your nails? Even though the term auto-cannibalism may make us picture cutting off our own arm and eating it, and yes, that is actually a part of it, it's typically nowhere near as extreme. In researching this episode, I went to some pretty dark recesses of the internet, and I actually found an auto-cannibalism support group online, and I decided to just look at some of the posts. One user said, quote, "I just found out I have auto-cannibalism. My urges are of eating my own skin, scabs, pus, etc. I've had it since I was a little girl, and now I'm causing myself to bleed, and I'm not sure how to deal with it." This is pretty much what it is. In the most extreme forms, it's cutting off a limb, an arm, a leg, something like that, and cannibalizing it. There have actually been cases of people who slowly but surely start to cut pieces of themselves off of their own body, like cut pieces of themselves to consume that. However, a couple things to note. Auto-cannibalism is incredibly rare, like incredibly, incredibly, incredibly rare. And two, it's rarely seen after an act of self-mutilation. It's almost done simultaneously with mutilation. So say, for example, it's people typically don't cut themselves and then later come back to cannibalize or take care of business. It's actually usually done one and the same for that purpose. And moving on, also in the first part of this series, I discussed how cannibalism is first typically broken down into two categories. We have exocannibalism and endocannibalism. Exocannibalism is a culture, group, or tribe's consumption of another culture, group, or tribe. Basically, they don't cannibalize their own. They don't shit where they eat. They take care of their community. Now, this type of cannibalism is typically associated with tribal power, murder, aggression, and has been used in an effort to scare off potential invading enemies. And a lot of cannibalistic tribes believe that consuming one's enemy would allow them to obtain and absorb the spirit and skills of their victims. Endocannibalism is the consumption of members within one's own culture, group, or tribe. And now this is often associated with ritual and mortuary cannibalism. And in fact, ritual cannibalism is the most widely practiced form of endocannibalism. And this primarily focuses on an already deceased person or corpse. And that being said, I think it's safe to say that one of the world locations that people think of when they think of cannibalism is Papua New Guinea. Smithsonian did a story back in 2006 called Sleeping with Cannibals, and it catapulted this country back into the spotlight. And there's a good reason for the press. The only tribe in the world that's known to practice cannibalism is there, like they still actively practice it. They're called the Korowai. Sometimes Kolufu. 60 Minutes even did a story on them back in 2003. And if you're really feeling sassy, you can actually hire a guide to take you there. There are roughly 3,000 members of this tribe dispersed around southeastern Papua New Guinea, and some villages are far more isolated than others. They live about 100 miles inland from the Arafura Sea, and if you recall, this is where Michael Rockefeller, a son of then New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller, disappeared in 1961 while collecting artifacts from another Papuan tribe. Which, if you know that story, he and his friends basically got lost in the ocean. Nelson Rockefeller jumped off the boat and said that he was going to swim like 10 miles to the nearest land to get help, and he was never seen or heard from again. His death was ruled a drowning officially. However, years later, I believe it was a Christian priest. Of course, missionaries ended up in Papua New Guinea. The local tribe there had come across him exhausted on the beach and killed him and eaten him. Now, the first date of outside contact officially was 1974, and that was when researchers actually made contact. And again, then more Christian missionaries came and began to convert some of them. and this allowed insight into their beliefs and superstitions. The Kuroi believe that it is necessary to kill and eat a person they believe has been taken over by a kakua, or demon, and this includes anyone who suffers from disfiguration, illness, infectious disease, etc., or even some outsiders, particularly white people. In fact, they call white people laleo, which translates literally as ghost demons. But they don't only eat outsiders or people that they don't respect. They also eat the deceased. And this is a task that's given to women. The women, when, say, a loved one, you know, think about it, your aunt dies. The women of the village would prepare her. They would clean her. They would come together, ritually clean her. Then they would butcher her, cook her, and then eat her together. And this is supposed to be because women are so strong that only the women in the village could deal with the unsettled spirits of the deceased relative, of the deceased tribesperson. And I find that strangely beautiful, like female power, like represent or whatever, but yeah. And the way that this was discovered is because there was a very rare disease that happened. It's called Kuru. And it's caused when an infectious protein found in contaminated human brain tissue is consumed by another person. And the way that this disease was discovered is that a bunch of Papua New Guineans began to get ill, especially children. As much as they said that it was witchcraft, demons, and sorcery, it wasn't. It was actually Kuru. It's also called the laughing disease. And it makes you laugh because, quote unquote, laugh, shall I say, due to the body tremors. That's actually the classic symptom of Kuru. Kuru itself, the actual word, means trembling because there are pathologic bursts of laughter. It actually happened in children because these women who were eating relatives or, you know, eating, taking care of these spirits and settling them by eating human flesh and brains and bodies would sneak their children little scraps of flesh. And their children were getting sick too. So that's how this disease was discovered. And it's truly fascinating. But if you can, I would definitely find the article Sleeping with Cannibals. It's truly fascinating. And again, if you are feeling, you know, carefree and sassy for a couple $1,000s, you too can hire yourself a guide and go visit this tribe. And last but not least for this episode, we are going to discuss Epicurean cannibalism. In 1981, Issei Sagawa, a 32-year-old Japanese student studying in France, was arrested for murdering and cannibalizing a fellow student. Issei had a crush on one of his fellow classmates, a Dutch woman named Renee Hartveld. He asked her to have dinner at his apartment one evening, but his real motive is that he wanted to murder her. Not only murder, but also consume her to absorb her qualities. He felt that she was beautiful, vivacious, attractive and smart, and he felt like he was none of those things. He told her that they could have dinner as they worked on a poetry translation project that they were doing for a class. And so Renee took him up on this offer. And as Renee was reading poetry with her back turned towards him, Issei shot her dead with a rifle. He then immediately had sex with her corpse. He also tried to bite into her body, but wasn't able to do so because his teeth were not sharp enough. So he left, went to a local shop, and bought a butcher knife. And Issei Sagawa spent the evening butchering her body. He consumed her face, breasts, and buttock first, and then he replaced the remainder of the remains in the refrigerator. He also took an incredible amount of pictures of himself eating various parts of her body, and these are available online for you curious people. He later packed up the uneaten remains into two suitcases and attempted to dump them in a local lake, but he was immediately arrested by police after being quite literally caught in the act of doing it. And if you think that, okay, well, this man went to prison, at least for a pretty considerable amount of time, or even a mental institution. Hell, we'll take a mental institution for murder and cannibalism. You'd be wrong. Issei Sagawa was found incompetent to stand trial by reason of insanity and sentenced to be held in a mental institution. Now, this was France, right? This is where it all happened. The charges were ultimately dropped after he told his story to a journalist who published the ordeal back in Japan, where he became a huge fucking celebrity. People were like, wow, he's so cool. What a freak. But like, oddly obsessive in following him. In France, not wanting to deal with the bullshit, was like, cool, cool, well, we'll just deport him. And they did. But because the charges were dropped against him, his file was not handed over to the good people of Japan. Thus, they could not arrest or charge him for murder or anything else. The second he landed in Japan, he was a free man with no criminal record. And, you know, because 2019 to 2022, the last couple of years, just haven't tarnished your hope for humanity enough at this point, Issei Sagawa became a massive celebrity in Japan. He's appeared on dozens, if not at least 100 talk shows, news segments, laughing about what happened to Renee Hartveld, talking about how he cooked her, what he did, what she tasted like, what humans taste like. And he's still alive today. The most recent that I found is 2020, 2 years ago. He was still alive in Japan. He's on public assistance and he has like a home health aide. And there is a picture of him, I believe, from 2019 as well. And he's not looking so hot, but what the fuck? Issei's original proclamation to police, we're backstepping here for a second. Issei's original proclamation to police is that he'd always had a fetish for eating human flesh. He'd always fantasized about it, wanted to do it, wanted to taste it, and wanted to feel it. Solely because he wanted to know what it tasted like, right? Which, side note, guys, we now know from all of his interviews that humans apparently taste like pork, just so you know. But had he stopped there and said, I just wanted to taste this, that would have been Epicurean cannibalism. People who consume flesh in order for taste or texture. That's what that would have been. However, many psychologists, therapists, and, you know, like smart-minded people way above my pay grade interviewed Issei over time and, you know, in prison in the mental institution, and they discovered that the murder wasn't just about human flesh. He had the full-scale fantasy of murdering, raping, and then cannibalizing a victim. So Issei, at this point in the story, be taken out of the Epicurean column for cannibalism and placed squarely into pathological cannibal. And we will be covering pathological cannibalism in the next and final episode of this series. Pathological cannibalism, guys, deserves its own full episode because that is the type of cannibalism that everyone is so fascinated with. That's your Jeffrey Dahmers. That's the Edward Kemper. That is the Armin Mavis. If you haven't heard his case, I covered that about a year ago. Go check it out. German cannibal, got on a cannibal forum, had a fantasy, lifelong fantasy of eating another human and found a willing victim. And that's exactly what they did. So the final episode will be pathological cannibalism, and we will be picking up there next week. Again, you're listening to We Saw the Devil. I'm Robin. This week on the docket, we have the final episode in the Marilyn Monroe series coming later this week. And then next week, we will tie up the cannibalism series. Also, there is a Suzanne Morphew case update in the works, guys. I don't know if any of you guys have been following the Suzanne Morphew case. It's actually, I've needed to take a break. Like, I have not been able to talk about it because it's frustrating me so badly, but we'll cover that in greater detail. But it looks like the case against Barry Morphew is crumbling. And I think that you, me, and everyone knows that it's highly, highly, highly probable and likely that Barry Morphew killed Suzanne based on the at least in the very bare minimum circumstantial evidence that they have like already. But it seems as though that case is crumbling, which is really concerning. But we are going to have an update episode on Suzanne Morphew as well. So again, thanks for listening. Check us out, wesawthedevil.com, wesawthedevil across all social media. If you're digging the show, want to financially back the show, become part of the team, do so, patreon.com/wesawthedevil. And to all of our patrons, stickers are going out in the next couple days. Until next crime.